The Exarch Show, bringing you the world of archaeological open-air museums, experimental archaeology, ancient technology, and interpretation. Welcome to Finally Friday. My name is Mathilde Siebrecht, and today I am joined by two specialists focusing on the archaeology of food. Maeve Lestrange is a PhD candidate at University College Dublin, investigating food, culture, and identity in medieval Ireland from the 13th to 16th centuries, focusing especially on the culinary aspect of bread baking. She also writes a regular column for the Dublin Inquirer, describing how to cook a variety of medieval dishes. Farrell Monaco is an MA candidate at the University of Leicester, whose research centres on foodways, food preparation, food technologies, bread and bakeries, but in this case, in the Roman Mediterranean. She publishes recipes and food archaeology articles on her blog Tavola Mediterranea, which won Saveur magazine's Best Special Interest Food Blog Award in 2019. Farrell also holds regular presentations and workshops in museum, educational, and private settings, focusing on food and cooking in the Greco-Roman world. So welcome to both of you. As a start, I just want to say, so bread apparently is of interest. Why bread in particular?
Well, certainly for me, I think of bread as being a staple in my time, in medieval times, and well before that. The potato hadn't arrived in Ireland, and bread was really the daily carbohydrate. It was eaten at most meals. What do you think, Farrell?
For me, it's wonderful to actually look at the role of bread in Roman culture. And what I like about it is that it isn't just a lump on the counter like it is nowadays. It wasn't something that was neglected or taken for granted, for that matter. My studies of bread involve the form, the function, the symbolism, and the sustenance. Bread in the Roman world overlapped between the ritual, the domestic, the commercial. So for me, it's something that is quite complex and quite beautiful. It's represented very beautifully in the archaeological record, in the pictorial record, in the written word as well. So it was a huge, huge part of Roman daily life. So it tells us a lot more about ancient Rome, much more than just what they ate.
You're very, very lucky to have all that information. Here in Ireland, we have one piece of bread, a tiny, tiny piece of bread that was about 8th or 9th century. That's the only archaeological evidence of bread we have.
Was it leaven, Maeve, or unleavened?
No, it wasn't leaven. It was, we think it was probably an oat cake made with ground oat, you know, oat flour or meal, and perhaps whey, you know, the byproduct of curds and whey, if when you separate the curds from the whey. That's the only piece of evidence we have archaeologically. We have no manuscripts either. We have no mentions of bread, really, apart from in some accounts, you know, primary, I look at primary documents and bread is mentioned, but nothing at all like you said, and absolutely no picture of bread at all.
You're doing some serious detective work then. The one piece of bread evidence that was found in Ireland, what type of context was it found in?
It was found in County Cork, in an archaeologist called Michael Monk. He did a dig there and they found it in the context of a settlement. And it just caused huge excitement when somebody found a piece of bread because it's organic. It just doesn't last in the kind of soils we have here.
Yeah, indeed. That's wonderful. I used to live in Cork, so that makes me very proud.
Oh, I used to live in Cork.
Maybe Cork is what did this to us. Maybe Cork is what gave us the bread obsession.
Irish bread in the background. So you talk about settlements. So Farrell, what kind of context do you find your stuff in usually? Is it in everywhere?
So the bread samples that I've actually studied are the ones from Pompeii. And as far as I know, those are the only two contexts where bread remains have been found, given the nature of their preservation at Pompeii. All of the specimens are carbonized. So I am piecing together evidence from looking at physical evidence from Pompeii, looking at how the bread was written about, both in documentary and literary sources, and then looking at the pictorial representations of them to study their form, how they were represented in frescoes, how they were embellished in frescoes, in order to interpret which breads fit into which classes, who made the breads, what the breads meant symbolically, which breads overlapped between the ritual and the commercial or the domestic. And to me, I don't know, my husband thinks it's a sickness, but I think it's endlessly fascinating. And it's, you know, it's what I think about when I go to bed, what I think about when I get up. I'll be doing a particular type of research on something and then I'll always find myself going back to it because bread was so prominent in Rome. And current scholarly estimates think that grain made up 70% of the daily caloric content of the diet. So bread was hugely important. And then we know this as well from looking at the actual bakery structures that were all over the Roman Mediterranean, Pompeii, Sicily, Ostia, etc. So it was a large part of the daily life, large part of the economy. And again, it gives us a lot of information about Romans themselves.
One of the ways that I know we ate bread, and it's what I'm working off, is evidence for bread ovens, open-air bread ovens that were found through archaeological digs, excavations. We're pretty sure they're hemispherical, clay-domed ovens, communal ovens, that people would have baked breads in. I'm actually building one in our Center for Experimental Archaeology and Material Culture in my university, in University College Dublin, to test it, to see what it could be used for, the capacity, and what else it could have been used for, you know, when it was cooling down, because I don't believe that it would have been just used for bread and then just forgotten about. So I'm starting from the very beginning. You're very lucky that you have so much to go on.
That sounds absolutely fascinating. And I think for the type of people that we are, experimental, creative, in order to break things apart to understand them or put them back together or to understand the technology, I think that what you're doing is brilliant. It's kind of what's happening on my property as well, as I try to involve myself in all the processes in order to understand bread making. Unfortunately, I can't readily replicate a Roman mill, for example, because the materials have to be sourced. It's difficult to make. But we have an oven in the backyard that I use as well to try to do the baking in the same fashion. But I think that reconstructing the technologies is definitely the best route to understanding the labor that was involved, the time that was involved, etc. So kudos to you.
Well, thank you. I just have a fascination for them, because archaeologists, when they're digging, when they're doing excavations, they'll come across kilns and things. And I just became really interested in the idea that there were bread ovens out there. We have little clusters of them in the country, and they seem to have come into Ireland around the time the Anglo-Normans came to Ireland at the end of the 12th century. So I'm trying to see whether it was a direct influence from Anglo-Normans, or whether Gaelic Irish at the time, even though they shouldn't, I mean, you know, once somebody's here one generation, they shouldn't be called an Anglo-Norman. I mean, everybody was Irish, but I'd like to know who built them. I can tell you one thing, that's very time consuming, and it takes a lot of energy and a lot of strength, because internally they're about 1.3 meters. And so then the dome has to match that, of course. And I'm not quite finished building it. I'm almost finished. But unfortunately, with this lockdown, I had to stop doing it.
You're fortunate in that you can build it at the center and off of your property. In my case, I end up building contraptions in the backyard, and my husband always comes out and says, "What are you doing? What are you doing now?" He'll catch me trying to dig a pit oven in the lawn and tell me, "Put that back, put the turf back." So you're fortunate that you've got a dedicated space to do it in. You mentioned earlier that the evidence for the actual hemispherical, the domed ovens, came about around which period? 1100?
I'm looking at them from around 1200 to 1500.
So prior to that, then, do you think that the Irish made flatbreads using hearths on the ashes, or do you think that they used grills?
I do. I really believe that they had other ways of doing breads. And one of them, and we find evidence for it archaeologically as well, is under an upturned pot. So if you had a ceramic pot or a pottery pot, and you turned it upside down, you can create an oven. So archaeologists, we were finding a certain type of sooting on a pot, the sooting at the top rather than the bottom, which meant that the pot was inverted. And, you know, we were wondering, why would you invert a pot? And then I tried putting some bread underneath it and putting it on a stone, on a hearth, and it worked. I was able to cook bread that way. So I believe that that's one of the many ways that they would have done it. Also on a kind of skillet, on a stone, they would have been making flatbreads and a lot of oat cakes over here, because we had a lot of oat in the kind of damper parts of the country.
What's interesting about what you just said is, what you're talking about is exactly the same as a Roman clebonus. And it was a small ceramic cloche, basically, that was used for baking over top of an open fire or sitting on a grill over top of embers and ashes. And it, because it creates a small oven environment that is both hot and humid. And they used clebani for a long time before the large commercial ovens came into the infrastructure. So what you're talking about is very interesting to me, because it's like two independent technological advances happened that were exactly the same. And it's similar to what you wrote about in your article about that twice-baked butter bread as well, when you mentioned the trencher bread as well. The Romans also had trencher bread, and it was called mensa. And you'd dump all your food on top of it, and it would soak up oils and the sauces. And it was almost like it was a base that you could then eat afterwards or chuck it to the dogs or the slaves. It's interesting to see how different civilizations, different populations will progress in the exact same way when it comes to bread making.
Yes, that's very interesting. I didn't realize there was another name for it, because I know trencher. Over here in Ireland, I've come across two types of bread. One is called bread and the other is called pandemand. And yet, so close to us, the UK have wonderful sounding breads like manchettes, rastons, girdle breads, cheat breads. Over here, I can only find bread or pandemand. And pandemand would have been a leavened bread, a very fine wheaten leavened bread that the wealthier people in society would have eaten. Do you have that type of bread that would have been the best?
Absolutely. Yeah, there was a thrice bolted Penicillagenus that was meant for the elite as well. And it always struck me as odd, because yes, I know it's fluffier and it's lighter and it's prettier looking, it's not as heavy, but the nutrition is actually in the bran and the germ. So the wealthy were taking the lightest and the whitest, while the poor were getting the bran and the heavier dark breads, or breads that were made out of a single bolted flour. So yes, there are similarities there again, I guess. And that relates to the sensory aspects of bread making, and it relates to the texture of the bread, the appearance of the bread, you know, because I'm pretty sure that the medieval Irish, as the ancient Romans, they probably loved a good crumb like you and I do. Probably loved having a good look at a nice holy crumb.
Have you come across my strangest bread, perhaps? Is actually, I forgot about this one. It's called horse bread. It was bread that was made for horses that were going to travel to take, say, the Prior of Holy Trinity in Dublin, from Dublin to Drogheda, which is maybe, I don't know, 20, 30 miles. And they would buy horse bread before they went on a journey.
And was it for the horse to eat, or was it for the prior to eat?
It was for the horse to eat, but I do believe, and I have read somewhere, that the poor members of society may have indeed tried eating that as well.
Is it made out of barley or bran?
Mostly bran.
Yeah, it's the same as in Rome, marching biscuit or panis militaris. Bran bread was definitely a cast off. Barley was mainly for animals, but bran bread again would be for the slaves or the poor. It was the discard from the milling process. But once again, they understood the nutritional value of it. But I guess it was strictly about texture and taste when they decided that the poor should get the rougher bran breads and the elite would have access instead to the more labor intensive white breads or the Penicillagenus.
And what about breads that are made from pea and bean? Have you come across those?
Yeah, there's one particular bread called lamentum, which Pliny writes about. It's quite clever, and it actually lets us know about how bread was distributed and sold, because Pliny mentions that you could add bean meal to bread in order to make it heavier. So it's kind of cheeky when you think about it. So they would add bean meal into wheat bread to make it heavier so that you could make a bigger buck off the loaf.
In the UK, there's a bread called a girdle bread. And I had a colleague come to me a couple of months ago to ask me why he was coming up with so much dried peas in a kiln he was doing a report on. It had been excavated. And I suggested that maybe that was being turned into flour or turned into a meal that could be made into a bread. So I got some pea flour and I made these little cakes that I thought they would be like, and brought them into him to taste. And they have actually become very popular, especially with some fried onion on top.
That's fantastic. Yeah, I find that in recreating Roman breads, some of the ones that you would assume would be unpleasant, they're actually quite good. The unleavened breads that I've been making recently are actually quite good. The tile breads, the Herculaneum bath bread that I reproduced recently, they're quite good. There's nothing wrong with unleavened bread at all.
Yeah, same here. If I do, say, a festival, we have an alumni festival every year, or I'll make oat cakes every now and then. And I'll sometimes get the curd that's left over from separating the whey from the curd. And it's almost like a mild cottage cheese, and put it on top of the oat cake. And it actually tastes quite nice, I think.
Why don't I ask you, Maeve, in your research and in your experiments, what do you find difficult? What is a hurdle for you? Or what are you constantly trying to get past in your research or your experiments?
The lack of information is really quite frustrating. So I look at the archaeobotany reports and I look at the zoo archaeology. And for instance, there was a community dig happening in County Meath last year. And they asked me, what could they've eaten and what kind of breads might they've had? So I looked at what they had, and I looked at the cereals, I looked at the bone remains, the plant remains, and I said, well, I gave a talk and I said, well, you could have eaten all of these things. And I put up what I call the Black Fiery Feast. And they invited me back to cook this feast for them, which I did. And they were absolutely fascinated that with that much information, they could have eaten so much and so well.
It's fantastic. It's almost the opposite of what I'm dealing with in researching Roman breads, is there is some archaeological evidence. I know that there are a lot of other forms out there, but what I have to do is I have to work between the written record and the archaeological record. And I have to realize that when I'm reading accounts, for example, let's say the accounts of Pliny versus novels or poetry written by Petronius, for example, when you look at the Cana Trimalcionis or Trimalcio's banquet, I have to realize that, okay, I cannot take that literally. I can't look at that and say, okay, just because Archestratus said that there were this types of bread, or Petronius outlines this garish, crazy banquet, doesn't mean that that bread is in that exaggerated form. I actually have to dial things down a little bit and take the written word quite often with a huge grain of salt before I consider that it's interpreting anything accurately. So I tend to lean more towards the archaeology and the artistic representation of bread as stronger types of evidence.
That's really good. And that's something that I can't do. I have to work out myself what it is that could be done. But I do refer a lot to British writers, Chris Wilgar, Peter Breers, people like that, Maggie Black, I don't know if she's British actually, but I have to look at what they are doing. And I think there's an argument to be made that when the Anglo-Normans came to Ireland, that they possibly brought these kind of breads with them. So one of the classes I teach every now and then is, I call it the Great Medieval Bread Bake-Off, which is after the Great British Bake-Off, just for a bit of fun. And I get people to make those kind of, not from my own cooking, but especially from the UK model, which is very strong.
I wonder about, because bread did migrate, bread migrated with people. And I wonder, are you tracing types of bread between, let's say, France or Spain, Britain and Ireland? Are you able to see any form of migration in bread archaeology in Ireland, or is it fairly spotty as well?
Oh, it's quite spotty. I can certainly trace French and UK breads, and I will look at the Italian model because I really need to. But over here, because we have nothing, it's very hard to know how far to go. So that's why I'm looking at the technology of the bread ovens at the moment. And looking at the bread ovens in the UK and in Ireland and seeing if I can compare those. Because if I could come up with something successful to say that, yes, they had the same type of bread ovens in the UK as in Ireland, there would be an argument as well then for saying, well, if they had the same type of bread ovens, did they have the same type of breads? That's just one of the things I'm doing.
I absolutely love that aspect of this research too, is looking at the technologies and then looking at the various representations of bread in classical antiquity and seeing contact between cultures represented through it. And that's one of the most beautiful ways. Like we have amphorae. We can look at amphorae and we can see how people moved around the Mediterranean simply by studying the distribution of various transport amphorae. But bread acts in a similar way. If you can watch how it moved around the Mediterranean, how cultures brought it to certain places, how trade impacted the different styles of bread that were being made in different parts of the Mediterranean, it's incredible. It really is. Maeve, you were speaking about secondary, or the possibility of secondary uses of ovens, and something that we see in Roman domestic contexts is a lot of ovens were used not just for baking bread, but also for heating the baths. And so one of the studies that I'm doing right now is actually looking at bread being made in bath complexes. So they were very efficient with their energy, as they were with food, because everything was expensive. Everything was limited. It's not like now. I mean, the grain supplies were limited, and they had to make sure that they used absolutely everything. So they did the same with energy in their ovens as well.
It's really good, because I really believe that you wouldn't just bake bread, take it out, and let the oven cool down.
No, because everything was costly. Everything had value, much more than it does now.
Exactly. And the fuel that goes into a fire, or goes into making one of these fires. Yeah. So I'm going to try doing other things in it, in the oven as well, to see what would have been possible.
In Rome, the fuel came down from the mountains, and then wood was also imported, right? Because obviously Rome was deforested. Ireland was already also deforested upon colonization, or, you know, upon, you know, European migration. Were they using peat to make bread, or were they using wood, or were they using hay, or what were they using?
One of the fuels that I'm very fascinated with trying out is gorse. Do you know gorse? Furs?
No.
You know, it's got a beautiful yellow flower. I think it's in the autumn time, it has a flower. When it's dried, it becomes, it heats very quickly, and it's very efficient. It gets to a high temperature very quickly, and it burns very slowly. So that's definitely one of the things that I'm going to try. And I think that I'm just wondering whether the smoke from it would provide a slightly different flavor as well, because when you smell gorse, it's got a beautiful scent.
And that is a sensory aspect of that archaeology that would be completely lost had we not been experimenting. It would be complete, the flavor of the smoke with that. For example, like the cheeses that I make, that when I use fig rennet off of my trees in the backyard, it leaves a bitter undertaste to the cheese. And that is completely missed when you're looking at a fresco of cheese going, oh, look, Roman cheese. It's completely missed when you don't apply, you know, phenomenological or experimental approaches to recreating artifacts.
I agree.
Thank you for that very interesting discussion. As a final quick question before we open up to the rest of our listeners, what are your plans for the future in your research? And I guess more specifically, how can the XArt community help you in sort of making a difference in regards to food and archaeology?
Well, I want to finish writing my PhD thesis and to continue to spread the word about bread. I also find it very handy to network with people, other members of XArc. I spoke there at the conference in Trento last year, and I met some really interesting people there. And it actually was because of XArc that I think I started this journey, because there was an XArc conference in UCD, I think it was 2015. And I listened to a paper by Richard Fitch from Hampton Court Palace. He was talking about recreating medieval bread, and I became very interested. And I started looking at if anybody had been doing anything like that in Ireland. And in fact, I'm the first person, I'm pretty sure I'm the first person to be doing a PhD in archaeology of food, in food, this type of archaeology in Ireland. So that's me.
And as for myself, I too am doing a lot of writing, and actually I'm taking advantage of the current global situation and our lockdowns to actually catch up on my writing, because I juggle quite a fair bit throughout the year between traveling and writing. So I am taking the next couple of months to knock out my papers. As far as XArc goes, I attended an XArc conference a few years ago in Richmond. It was in Jamestown. Yeah, it was on the East Coast in the United States. And I too felt like I found my people, because I sat in a room and listened to people speak my language, people who had done the same type of in-depth research and experimentation as I had. And I said to myself, oh, thank God. It's a thing. There's people doing the same thing as I am. And so I'm really grateful that XArc is around. I would say, I mean, the only thing that I would do is increase an online presence, because what I try to do with my work and my research is a lot of public education, blogging, presenting videos to take all of this data to the public, because that's who it belongs to. So I would say, you know, just keep doing what you're doing, put the word out there, get the data out to the public, either online so that they can access it in their living rooms, and then find their own jumping off point, start their own reading processes, and we'll get more people interested.
Oh, that sounds like a very good idea. And hopefully this is a bit of a starting point for that, to make it a little bit more kind of, well, it's already open access, I guess, but a little bit more public, so to speak. So for people who might not already be a member, who would want to become a member, something like that. So this is basically, that's it from the pre-recorded session. I hope that everyone enjoyed that. And we will now be having a live question and answer session, people who have been listening into the discussion so far. So Farrell and Maeve, you're both women, and in a particular subject which is sort of more associated with the realm of women, one could say sort of domestic cooking, food preparation, etc. How do you think your research is viewed by academia, by the public, in that kind of respect?
I'm pretty sure I'm the first archaeologist in Ireland to do a PhD involving food in this manner, in a culinary way. But my research has been very favourably met in academic terms. I've been invited to speak at academic conferences without submitting applications. Just for instance, people just want to hear about it. And yes, it's been very favorable for me. How about Farrell?
I think my research is being received well, but I think that what's happening right now, and it's very interesting to watch this sudden interest take hold in our discipline, but also within the public arena as well. I think it's very timely. I think it's happening at a particular time. People are starting to take more interest in food in general. They are connecting with food again. Chefs and home cooks are standing up and they're saying, you know what, we've had enough of feeling disconnected from our food supply. We want to go back. We want to farm. We want to garden. We want to connect with our food supply. So a bit of this cross-cultural interest that's taking place both in food archaeology and then in modern food value as well. And the two of them complement each other beautifully. And then with respect to being a woman in the discipline, what interests me the most about this study is, again, okay, so we are women researching the realm of women, food and cooking. If it's domestic, it's women. If it's commercial, it's men, of course. What this type of archaeology does is it also shines a light on people who are generally absent in the archaeological record. And that's women, slaves, freedmen, liberti in the Roman archaeological record. So for me, it's political as well. So it's quite a beautiful area of archaeology that needs some light shone on it.
We also have a couple of questions from our listeners. So first, we have a question from Merit Honderlich, who's asking about the cereals that we use to bake bread from. So you discussed these a little bit already in your discussion. But do you happen to know more about regional preferences and also, for example, regarding urban versus rural regions?
Is this for Ireland or Rome or both?
I guess for both. If there is any is there any evidence of sort of regional differentiation between different cereals that are used?
I can speak briefly to that. Pliny tells us about where grain was sourced. In ancient Rome, they sourced their grain regionally, in a limited manner, because they didn't have enough grain growing regionally to feed the populace. But they sourced the majority of their grain from North Africa, as well as colonies in Sicily, at Sardinia. And, you know, particularly following the Third Macedonian War, where there was a huge economic boom and urbanization, they required grain, so they began to source it in the provinces than they did in regional settings. And the Romans were using primarily spelt wheat, and then they were also using millet as well in poorer populations.
How was the situation in Ireland then, Maeve?
In Ireland, we had wheat. The dominant one was wheat. We became very good wheat growers after, I keep saying the Anglo-Normans, I know that, but after they arrived in Ireland, we did become, whether it's coincidence or not, I don't know. So we became really good wheat growers. Then there were oats. We had a little bit of rye and barley. Wheat would have been eaten by the aristocratic members of society, whereas oats would have been probably the poorer members of society.
Which relates, I guess, to what you were saying earlier about the poor were actually getting more to food, so to speak, in terms of sustenance. As a follow-on from that question, do either of you know whether there were any regional differences in also using sort of alternative ingredients in bread, so peas or anything like that? especially this particular speaker, Saz, is interested in the medieval period in Ireland, but also, I suppose, Farrell, if there's any evidence of that in Rome.
Well, just for the medieval period in Ireland, we have absolutely no evidence at all. We only know that bread was eaten. There is no description about what the bread was. We don't know. We have no, there are no recipes for bread, nothing. So I think we can just go by what's found, what evidence, archaeobotanical evidence is found near, say, where a bread oven might have been excavated. And that might give a clue as to what type of cereal was used in the bread.
Do you know what sort of things were going on in the UK, sort of in the rest of Britain at that time?
Yes, they had very, I don't know regionally in the UK, but they certainly had very interesting breads and very different types of breads and many, many different types of breads there, which is why I look to the UK model, because I find it very informative.
And is there any evidence of that in Rome or Roman period, I mean?
I imagine that the Romans would be using, again, what they had on hand. Was during times of prosperity, they would have a lot of wheat. If it was during times of war or famine, they would have used alternative grains, maybe even stooping so low as to use barley. Looking at the archaeological record, it's difficult to look at carbonized bread and determine they're actually getting into it. But we can look at archaeobotanical evidence, such as wheat that was found in the bakery of Modestus. It was not spelt, it was wheat that was found, Triticum estivum, in one of the mills. So we know that in 79 AD in Pompeii, they were using wheat in this particular bakery to make bread. Then, you know, leaning away from archaeology, we can always look at the written record and we can look at the many sources of data like Virgil or Varro or Pliny and look at the types of ingredients that they document. And that's where it gets a little bit more interesting. We're looking at bean meal, poppy seeds, fennel, parsley, different types of grain, and then tacky stuff like gypsum and chalk. Order to make the bread whiter, which is,
oh my gosh, that sounds horrendous.
Disturbing. It's very disturbing. But you know, so they were tampering with their breads, adding strange ingredients to it to affect it aesthetically as well as taste.
To make it look good rather than taste good necessarily.
Yeah.
Oh gosh. This next question from Kohava relates more to the technology. The next couple of questions do actually. He has, how can you see that a bath oven was also used for bread? What kind of evidence would you find for this?
That is actually something that I'm researching right now, and I will lean heavily on my friend Christina, who is a bath expert. I have primarily done my research strictly in commercial settings, commercial bakeries, so leaning towards the domestic or the domestic where they would baths and bake bread in the same oven, or looking at a bath complex to see how it was done. I'd be looking at any kind of joining systems where the oven would also be heating hypocauster underneath the floors, for example, or underneath the bath itself. I would be looking for connections, but right now I'm in the early stages of doing that research. So I will be leaning on Christina Hernandez quite a fair bit if she's out there. She knows that we'll be chatting about it more in the future.
Well, sounds like some good potential collaboration for that then. Related to this, the next question by Colin Wren is, he says that ceramic baking covers are amazing. Apparently, the bread blogging community apparently advocates using Dutch ovens for this. And he asks, how can you determine that a ceramic vessel was used for that, so for baking bread, I suppose, rather than for anything else? A particular sort of evidence you can say, yes, this was definitely used for bread.
Certainly in medieval times, I don't think there's any way of knowing why there was sitting on the top of ceramic pot. It's a theory. I don't know of any real evidence for it, but it can be done and we have done it. So I can't think what else might be done in that way, but I certainly will keep an open mind about it.
And the same would go for ancient Rome. We know that clebani were used to make bread, but it was also used to cook other food items as well. And again, you have to look at the clebanus as a mini oven. It creates an oven environment. And any bakers who are out there know that if you are going to use modern ceramic cloche or a Dutch oven, it creates a humid, hot environment to make bread in. It's almost like putting an oven inside of an oven, because nowadays we do it by sticking it in our conventional ovens. In ancient Rome, you would use it more in a domestic context or prior to this economic boom that happened around 168 BC, where commercial bakeries popped up in the infrastructure, because then you had a mass distribution of ovens. Mani, of course, would be used in domestic settings where in Pompeii, for example, 50% of people did not have baking ovens in their homes. They had to use hearths. So it's basically like a small portable oven that you use on a cooktop, on a hearth, you can use it only, or you can use the base as well.
Just in relation to that, there was just another point that was made by another listener, Ligieri, talking about in rural France up until the 50s, apparently the ovens were sort of used for multiple functions. So she mentions that after bread baking, the temperature would slowly drop. And then depending on the temperature, people would use it for other tasks. So tool sterilization or all those kind of things. So I guess, yeah, they can be, even if they're primarily for bread, they can still have all sorts of other uses or multifunction.
Efficient.
Yes, yeah, exactly. So moving on, oh, we have another question about sort of technology by Outdoor Academic. She first of all says, this is a great talk, so well done. And she has an Emma bread with sourdough and Hallstatt salt in the oven, apparently. I'm definitely going to have to eat some bread after this. I'm really hungry. She was interested in learning more about baking bread on stones and was wondering if either of you knew which stones might work best or which stones they might have used in the past, perhaps, as well.
I certainly think slate is something that would have been used. I haven't done a lot of experiments on this yet because my experiments are still, a lot of them are to come. But I do believe that slate would have been, it has been found certainly in the base of some bread ovens that have been excavated. And I think it would have been a good one. Offhand right now, being far away from my research, I cannot think of anything else right now.
That's the problem with being in isolation.
As for me, my experience is only with basalt oven floors and then ceramic bases or the tops of platforms.
So next question is from Rick Soudan, talking about the point that you made, Farrell, where Roman bakers would add in extra ingredients to make the bread look better, but not necessarily taste better. Apparently the same was done in Victorian Britain, but then a legislation was made to ban some of them. Do you know if there were any prohibitions in Rome related to this kind of thing?
Not as of yet, no. I haven't seen anything related to prohibitions. I do think it's an interesting subject, though, because look at some of the dangerous practices that took place in Victorian England. There's similar, more recent practices that took place in New York City, for example, during the turn of the century. A lot of people populating lower Manhattan. There's a museum there called the Tenement Museum where they discuss how chalk also used to be added to milk to extend milk. And it was very dangerous. It made people, a lot of people sick. You know, the Romans knew, for example, that lead was poisonous, but they still used lead pots to make defrutum. I don't recall seeing anything, but I haven't come across it yet that said, all right, everybody, stop using lead pots for making your defrutum. But, I would say that regulations were probably a little bit looser than, safety regulations were much looser than they are in the modern day.
Imagine probably a little bit more. in moving away a bit from technology now, though we'll probably come back to it, I see from the next couple of questions. Caroline Jeffra would like to know if either of you have a favorite reconstructed bread recipe. And I do know that both of you do a lot of kind of experimental baking, so to speak. And do you have any that you're willing to share now, or do you have them online somewhere? And what makes them special to you?
I have a lovely one. It's from the UK again. It's I think it's called a raston, where you bake a bread and you cut off the top, and it's leavened bread. You take out the crumb and you mix it with clarified butter, and you put it back into the bread and put the lid back on the bread again and bake it again, and it is quite delicious. That's certainly one that I would recommend. There are others as well. I mean, I'm a sourdough baker, and I believe that. Because the leaven is a natural one, I believe that would have been around in ancient times as well. So probably my favorite bread to bake right now myself is a good sourdough. I love it, and I put all kinds of things into it from nowadays, from chili flakes to anything that will flavor it. Duca is another one, but I don't think they were doing that, putting in the flavorings in medieval times. What about you, Farrell?
There's a myriad of bread recipes on my site that people can try, and it will satisfy people that are interested in working with different forms and bread as a symbol of something, or bread that incorporates a lot of weird and wonderful ingredients that we don't use in our modern breads. Probably off the top of my head, the most favorite one that I have and the one that I make most often for my family, and the ones that go over the best in my workshops, these little things called grape muskcakes. Haedo, of course, preferred to make without yeast. There's other documentation of these breads being made with yeast. And they are a knockout. They're just amazing. It incorporates sweet and savory. You've got grapes. You have cheese, like fresh ricotta, or freshly made cheese with cumin. So you've got this huge, beautiful combination of flavors that when you bake them, they blow up into these lovely little biscuits. And they're crunchy because of the sugars coming off of the grapes. And it contains no water at all. It's all just grapes, cheese, cumin, anise. And you can knock about 10 back in one sitting. They're really good.
I suppose to get the real proper old-time flavor, you have to add a bit of chalk in as well.
Yeah, just for that extra grit in your teeth, yeah.
Okay, we have another question here from Merritt, who's curious about the location of the communal ovens in Ireland, although maybe they also had communal ovens sort of in the Roman kind of regions. Would these ovens be positioned in a certain part of the settlement, so in the center, in the edge, near the mill, assuming the people sort of milled the flour or did not mill the flour themselves?
I don't know the answer to that fully, but I can tell you that some outdoor ovens were built against a wall. I mean, the reason for an outdoor oven is fire safety as much as anything else. They might have been leaning against a wall. The ones that I'm most interested in are completely on their own. So I need to look to see. They would have been part of a settlement, but I can't exactly trace whether they were in the centre and houses all around them. They would have been part of a community, but I don't think there's any particular layout of, housing close by. I think perhaps they would have been just as part of a settlement rather than in a particular place. I hope that answers the question. But the ones against walls, obviously, we find those sometimes if there's a tower house or a small castle, there might be evidence of some against a wall, which will probably be across from where the kitchen is in that area. So they would have, a cook or the baker would have gone out to use the bread oven outdoors there.
Were there sort of communal ovens in the Roman regions?
So with respect to this question, Pompeii is an example. It's generally accepted and understood that before extant commercial bakeries at Pompeii were communal. There is a handful of them, though, that were domestic but were producing commercially. And we know this by the amount of mills that were present in these homes. But a large amount of these commercial bakeries at Rome, at Pompeii and at Herculaneum, were considered communal because we can look at stamps, determine that. So the one Panis Quadratus that was found at Herculaneum that was stamped with a slave's name, is the property of this certain slave who worked for a certain person, tells us that the bread that was being baked was meant to be collected and taken back to this particular house. Then, you know, we can also see stamps that were regarded as branding or just a decoration, for example. But definitely a Pompeii, when you consider, once again, that 50% of people that lived there did not have cooking facilities, which is why they ate out a lot in various bars or taberna, would have also possibly had their bread made in these communal bakeries, and then they would collect it and take it back home.
It's an efficient way of getting your bread.
Yes, I've just been reminded. I mean, we had bakeries as well, none of which survive, but there were bakeries there, and it would have been the baker himself who would have had a mark. And it was just for quality purposes, the baker had to identify what bread he baked. But they would have been in, there were very few cities, but there were certainly bakeries in Dublin City, for instance, and I would say in perhaps Waterford or Cork as well.
So our next question here is from Jenny Loder, talking about flatbreads now. Is there any evidence in either of your regions for baking flatbreads on the outside of pottery kilns? Is this even possible? I don't know if this is something you've tried in your experiments.
I've certainly heard about this. There is no evidence that I have come across. I've certainly heard about it, and it's something I want to try. Actually, I want to try on the outside of my bread oven when it's up and running. I'm going to try and bake flatbreads on the outside of it. I'm just going to try doing everything with that oven. I'll be experimenting for hopefully if I get back to it for the whole summer. But certainly one of the things I want to test how hot it is outside and whether anything could have been done on the outside of the oven, on the outside of the clay when it heats up. I had a smaller one in UCD, a little bread oven some years ago, and I didn't try to do anything with it, but it got nice and warm on the outside. Next time I will. So next time I talk about this, I'll be able to tell you whether you could cook anything on the outside of a bread oven or a kiln. I'm not sure about kilns, but certainly I will be able to talk about bread ovens.
I myself have never come across evidence of bread being made on the outside of a kiln.
Be something for someone to try, one of these lovely experimental archaeologists who've joined us today. Make a nice pottery kiln, and then when you're done, make yourself a flatbread to give yourself a bit of a treat. Okay, moving on to the next question by Pascal Barnes, our chair of Exarch. She asks, were the majority of leavened breads in Rome of a sourdough type? Someone mentioned sourdough earlier.
This is a really interesting question, and it's something that I've been playing around with for quite a number of years. People get hung up on sourdough quite a fair bit because Pliny writes about it. When you're thinking about bread making on a grand scale, on a commercial scale, think about the ovens at Pompeii, for example, which are about 5 meters cubed area of the oven floor. Think about the high volume of bread that can be output in commercial settings in ancient Rome. The idea of inoculating that much bread dough daily is problematic, because you're thinking about inoculating a lot of bread dough. And any home baker, any professional baker knows that it takes quite a fair bit of time for sourdough to chew away at the fresh dough, create a leavened product. So what I've been doing recently, having talks with some friends in Rome who are also in the same racket as I am, Christina and Giorgio back in Rome, is considering the dough might have actually been rested. You can ferment dough naturally by leaving it sit in a warm human environment, or just out on the counter, or out of the fridge, for example, which of course they didn't have in ancient Rome. But if you leave it sit in the open air, can ferment naturally, or you know, for a period of a day or two, and you will create a leavened product. It makes more sense to me that they actually made massive amounts of dough and then shoved it off to the side and let it sit. It makes more sense to me. It's more efficient than trying to inoculate dough with a starter. But they may have done it as well, but a starter is essentially just old dough. It's fermented dough that you keep on hand, and you continually to pay it forward into the next batch in order to ferment fresh dough.
That seems very relevant for now, because I know that all of the people who are self-isolating at home at the moment seem to be going crazy for sourdough. So it seems to be a popular thing to be trying out at the moment.
It's one of the reasons why I put up that video recently, to tell people not to panic. You don't need to have a sourdough. You don't need to toil away at making a sourdough. You can just leave your dough on the counter for 48 hours and you will have a leavened product.
I was going to say that we're having dreadful problems getting strong flour anyway. It's very hard to buy strong flour nowadays with this lockdown. So I do make sourdough, but I've been making it for quite a long time. It isn't just a recent COVID virus sourdough.
No, yeah, that sounds good. There's also some good, nice feedback here from David Freeman, who says he's cooked a lot of breads in different construct. He also suggests dipping into beer froth to make your yeast.
Yeah, that's right. Barm. The top of the beer would have been used as a leaven.
Sounds very interesting. But David also mentions that he's cooked bread in constructs of British Iron Age ovens, so with and without a container, with and without a fire left in the oven. He's cooked flatbreads on coals and on stones, and he finds that sedimentary rock tends to crack. Igneous works well, especially when sourced from the seashore or the river where they've been ground down and rounded. So thank you, David, for that feedback. That was very helpful. We also had a question from Mark Cox, who is asking about the Georgian tome ovens. I'm not sure how to say that. He's put a little photo in the chat channel in case anyone wants to have a look at it. Is this something that's familiar to you?
I'd be very interested in having a look at it and giving an opinion. I'm just not great with technology.
Unless it's ancient.
No, well, yeah, bread ovens, yes. Computers. Speaking of, Ligieri has a quick question. Being interested in prehistoric archaeology, they were wondering if you'd have any information about the origins of bread. So he mentions that they date back to the Neolithic and the Near East, but are there any archaeological traces that you might know of sort of in the early stages? I know that this is a bit out of your specialized regions and time periods, but if you know anything about this.
There was a recent study that was published last summer or the summer before that was coming out of Jordan, where a Natufian hearth was discovered, and there was archaeobotanical remains of what they believe to be breadcrumbs. But this would be, and it was about 14,000 years BPA, I think, 14,000 years ago. They believe that they found early forms of flatbreads, cakes being made on a hearth.
It's been a part of our life for a long, long time. So I have one more quick question, and then we will see if anyone writes one more question in the next minute or two, and then we'll finish up for the day. So experimental archaeology usually requires sort of collaboration with specialists. I mean, I know the work I do, I have to work with prehistoric technology experts. But of course, with cooking, were either of you sort of heavily involved in cooking or in food before you became experimental archaeologists? Do you think that this is a requirement for anyone wanting to get into this kind of research?
Yeah, I'm very much a foodie, very much a home cook. I'm also married into a large Italian family. So cooking is a big part of our home life. I don't think it is a prerequisite, though. I think that anybody that is curious, creative, studious, involved in this type of thing, I think you have to have a general interest in old cooking technologies to be curious about food production, procurement, agriculture. You don't have to have the background, but I think it does help really when you can feed people in your family the products and the experiments.
For me, I'm the same. I'm a huge foodie. Food is, I think about it so much, and I read any cookbook that's put my way, and I'm always trying different recipes. And I have two daughters who are exactly the same. I worked in a cookery school for a while, testing and developing recipes. That was because I really just loved doing it. And so for me, it was always about food. And I approached my supervisor in UCD to say that I wanted to do experimental archaeology of food. I was very aware that it hadn't been done before. So, yes, to answer the other part of the question, no, you don't have to have any special. I think once you have the interest, once you really want to do it, I think that's really all you need.
Well, that's very good to know. And I mean, like you say, food is, both of you just mentioned, food is such a good thing to be specialized in, because there's always going to be someone around to help you eat off your experiments and do some taste tests, I'm sure. Right, I think that's it for today. Quick question before I wrap up. Where can people find out what you're both doing? I know that a couple of people have shown interest in constructed bread recipes or other sort of recipes. Where can they find information about this?
For my research and my experiments and recipes, you can find them all online. My website is called tavlamediterranea.com, but that's a big, long word. So if you just Google my name, Carol Monaco, you'll be able to find interviews, recipes, as well as events and workshops that are delayed this year, naturally, because of what's going on right now. But I hope that by the fall or the winter, be more museum presentations and hands-on workshops taking place, because I really enjoy actually meeting people face-to-face and baking together and discussing history and the research together as we make bread.
I don't have a website. I'm still finishing off my PhD. So I haven't, the only recipes for bread that I would have published would have been in the Dublin Inquirer. But if anybody wanted to get in touch with me, feel free, and could certainly put some recipes together, because the recipes that I teach to students in UCD, I have those somewhere on my laptop.
Great. Well, that sounds good. And there seem to be a couple. David Clerc just suggested also there's an Iron Age forum, Celticos, which has a lot of recipes for bread. So if people want to check that out, that sounds good. Thank you very much, both Maeve and Farrell, for joining us and sharing your experience and expertise. I know I certainly learned a lot about bread. I'm sure our listeners did too. So thank you both very, very much.
Thank you. And thanks to everybody for showing up today.
Yes, indeed. Same for me. Thank you very much. And it's been a pleasure getting to know you and getting to know Farrell. And I just know Farrell and I will be in touch with each other again.
Indeed. I'm so happy that we actually got to chat in this forum finally.
Yeah, me too.
Hopefully this is the start of many collaborations.
Thank you, Exmoor. Thank you for the opportunity.
Yes, and thank you everyone else for listening to this episode of Finally Friday by Exarc. If you'd like to become more involved with Exarc and you're not a member already, why not become a member? We're great. We're really friendly. I can tell you I recently became a member and it's fantastic. Alternatively, you can also make a small PayPal donation through the Exarc website to help support Exarc in its endeavors. See you next month for another episode of Finally Friday. Bye, everyone.